45,000 photographs in the building.
Oh, you mean the sessions?
Yeah, people playing. There about half of them are of the sessions, and the other half are out of the fourth floor window.
It's funny. It's very sort of bleak areas. I remember it was like Flower Market on 6th Avenue in the 20s, which no longer exists, like most of New York. Must have been. I'm curious how they must have been very kind of austere photographs, or they were like a lot of little detail out the window. I mean, did he use telephoto or did he?
Yeah.
Just, ah, so he could get into stuff.
Yeah, he used telephoto a lot. I can show you some of those if you're interested.
Well, no, not really. Okay. I mean, we're just here to do what we're here to do.
So the project it started out about Smith, but then as I started interviewing people, I've interviewed over 250 people from who were in that loft in one capacity or another. And as I began interviewing people like Phil Woods,
I think he was there a lot.
Yeah, and Billy Taylor.
I wouldn't know.
This figure of Hall Overton, like every interview I did, it's like who is this guy? Because it became apparent to me that he was really influential, beloved.
He was one of those people who was behind the scenes. I mean, he did record. There are a few recordings with him on it, I believe, but I don't have any. But a lot of people who you wouldn't think studied with anybody studied with Hall, Jim Hall, Jim Rainey, Mal Waldron. And, of course, all the Thelonious Monk. But we're getting into what she was talking about.
How did you meet him? When did you first hear about him?
I was at Cornell, and I was about to graduate. I was at Cornell from 1953, 1957. And when I graduated in 57, I had the choice of either going to Harvard as a graduate student in philosophy and doing a PhD in what would have been continuing work in Ludwig Wittgenstein, or going down to New York and studying composition and becoming a composer. And I just couldn't face the idea of an academic life. And I had a lot of encouragement at Cornell from Professor William Austin. William Austin was he was a musicologist, but he was a very good pianist. He was a very good organist. He was my primary music teacher at Cornell. And he was very encouraging that I, pursue my desire to be a composer. And the question was how. And I don't know how he knew of Overton. It very well may have been that he knew Vincent Persichetti. And Hall had been a student of Vincent Persichetti when Hall was at Juilliard. And I never spoke with... Persichetti was also one of my teachers. And Hall was my teacher before that. And I knew that Hall had a very high regard for Persichetti, and I think Persichetti probably was instrumental in bringing Hall up to Juilliard shortly before he passed away. Shortly before Hall passed away, and not too long after that, Mr. Persichetti passed away. So William Austin somehow got wind, and Austin was very well aware of the fact that I was a jazz drummer. I was a philosopher during the weekend, jazz drummer on the weekends. And Austin was aware that I needed to study with somebody who would sort of cover both those bases. And I guess, my guess is, I don't really know, but my guess is through Persichetti or just through his own, his antenna were out, thought Hall Overton would be the ideal teacher, since he was a composer, had a very solid, traditional musical background, and was, I think I had Sparrow coming back from South Carolina. Can I just take a short break?
Sure.
Where were we? How I got the Hall?
William Austin,
yeah. So I think William Austin, gave me a great steer. I said, why don't you go down to New York State with Hall Overton, privately. This was June 1957. So I did precisely that. I went down to New York and I contacted Hall and I got a day job. And I started working with him, I guess, either summer, late summer, early fall of 57. And he got me back. I had been, as a child, I'd studied piano and stopped and started studying snare drum. And when I was 14, it was Roland Koloff, who ended up being the Tempest was in the New York Philharmonic, but in the days I was studying with him, he was the local good drummer in Mamaroneck, New York, where we had moved from New York in 1950. Hall got me back to playing The Microcosmos of Béla Bartók, books 1 and 2, and working with the Hindemith Harmony book, which was a book of full of exercises and very little words, which is a very good approach. And then giving me, you know, very specific projects to do. Curiously, the Bartók, really, if you look at it, had everything in it that I subsequently became the backbone of my work, i.e. working with different kind of modes, not just major and minor scales, but, you know, Dorian, Phrygian, all different early, what were called church modes, but really also used in a lot of folk music, which is where Bartók was getting them from. And canons, rounds, which he introduces immediately in the first book of The Microcosmos. And Hall just had me, you know, write. I remember, I think the very first lesson, he said, now next week I want you to write, you know, a melody that goes starts at the bottom, goes all the way to the top. I want a melody that goes starts at the top, goes all the way to the bottom. A melody that goes up, and he just drew these shapes. And I said, well, Hall, I said, we haven't studied anything yet. He said, how can I start composing? I don't have enough technique. He said, you'll never have enough technique. And you write these pieces. And that's absolutely true, no matter how you slice it. There are people who have a gift for teaching. I don't. He did. Persichetti did. And that's a very different gift than a gift for composition, let's say, or a gift for playing, you know, alto saxophone. In composition, it's particularly difficult. Most of the composers that we know and love did not teach. You know, Ives sold insurance, Aaron Copland conducted and played the piano, George Gershwin played the piano, Beethoven played the piano, Bach played the organ and conducted from the keyboard. Béla Bartók refused to teach composition because he was offered that, and he was connected with a number of schools, but as a piano teacher. Teaching composition is a very difficult thing to do, and Hall was very good at it, and so was Vincent Persichetti. And I think it's because they were able to be very specific about what they were asking of you. Again, Hall, I was an earlier stage. Persichetti was at a later stage. Persichetti is a very great teacher because he has such a fantastic musicianship. It's such a virtuoso in terms of being able to play anything in any style, sit down and improvise a Bach fugue, a Beethoven sonata, you know, a Bartók impromptu, or, you know, look at your score and sort of take off on that. But he didn't have any desire or anything inside of him that would turn you into Vincent Persichetti. What he was good at is finding out what you needed on, you know, Wednesday at 2:15, in December of 2007. And there are very few people who can do that. They have to have a lot of musicianship, and they have to have a certain kind of ego structure that allows them to let that musicianship bear on you. Anyway, we want to talk about Hall. So Hall was pivotal for me to get me off on the right foot with solid background in traditional harmony, basic counterpunctal techniques, returned to at least a simple version of the keyboard, an introduction to some very simple music, i.e. Microcosmos, which was like, I think even Hall didn't realize how perfect a choice it turned out to be.
you know if he used that for all of his students?
I don't. You know, it's funny. I never met anyone who studied. Well, maybe I met one girl who met one, but I don't really have the faintest. I didn't know her very well, and I didn't really know any of his other composition students. All I knew is that there were a lot of jazz musicians coming in and out of the door. And so I knew that he did, and then he ended up on the Juilliard faculty in composition. And I don't really know who studied with him then. At that point, I was long gone. I mean, he was at Juilliard when I was probably either at Mills or had come back to New York after having finished my MA at Mills out on the West Coast. Came back to New York. I left New York in 1961 and came back in 1965. So I really can't say if that was a universal approach. I suspect the Hindemith Harmony book might have certainly been a universal approach. I think he probably would have maybe picked different books of the microcosms depending on your piano technique, or maybe he would have picked other things. I really don't know.
When you called him or went to your first lesson, did you say this is the kind of music I'm interested in composing? Or
no, I just told him, listen, I'm beginning. You know that I've written a few little simple pieces. And that William Morrison, recommended that I contact you, and I know that you work with jazz musicians, and you know I'm a great admirer of Miles Davis and Kenny Clarke and blah 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 and so on and so forth. And could we meet? And I think we met. And I don't remember the very first meeting, but I think it was a meeting and a lesson all rolled into one immediately. But very quickly, I mean, I was with Hall for about a year and a half, and then I actually went to Juilliard. It actually overlapped. I went to Juilliard Extension Division while I was with Hall, and then I went into the Juilliard School, and stayed in contact with Hall and showed him things from time to time, and then went away to California and came back. But as I say, by the time I came back in '65, I believe he was then at Juilliard, and I'm almost positive of that, and. I remember also that we crossed paths shortly after the very first recording I ever had, which was Come Out on the CBS Odyssey label, which I think was released in 1967. And I think that he listened to it and liked that, and we had some brief conversation about that. But I don't. When did Hall die?
72,
yeah. I don't think we had too much contact between 67, 68, and the end of his life.
William Austin's not still around.
Oh, no. He died, I'm guessing somewhere around 15 years ago, maybe more.
And you went to work with him once a week, roughly?
Well, I had two different kind of classes with him, music history class and a jazz analysis class. I remember William Austin standing at the blackboard and putting on a Charlie Parker record and going with the note heads, and then said, could you play it again? I got to put in the stems. I could have fallen off my chair. I mean, that's the kind of musician he was. There aren't too many people like that around, period. At the time that I was studying with Austin, at the time that I was studying composition, really starting and going clear on through the end of my MA in 1963 with Luciano Berio, the music world was really divided into two camps, which eventually became one camp only. When I first went to study with Hall, and when I was at Cornell, so I'm back in 1953, you were either with Stravinsky or you were either with Schoenberg. And I was with Stravinsky, and so was he. And by the time I left Juilliard, about 1961, and went to study out in the West Coast, I thought I was going to be ending up studying with Leon Kirshner, believe it or not, because he was at Mills. And in the time that I went to California, Kirshner went to Harvard, and Berio turned up at Mills. And that was like, I didn't know it at the time, but that was like a gift of God. But by the time I got to the time I was leaving Juilliard, it was clear that what Juilliard was teaching, which was kind of like a worn-out Americana, had been completely vanquished from the scene, because Igor Stravinsky, once he began writing 12-tone music, or not his version of 12-tone music, which year I can't say, but with pieces like Agon and Canticum Sacrum, I guess that's, what is that, in the early, very early, right after the neoclassic stuff, the Reich's Progress, so somewhere in the middle 50s, that was the last straw, you know. If the maestro himself, the master, sort of turned his back on, quote, himself, and picked up the really, because Schoenberg had died, and so it was a little less difficult to have to deal with the guy who lived not too far away from you in Hollywood, and Webern was dead, so Webern could become the saint in absentia. But then the whole music world was, you know, there was no place to hide, so. You either wrote, I mean, now I'm talking, you know, from somewhere in the very late 50s on through well after I left school, into the 80s. You either wrote 12-tone serial music, or you were a fool. You were disregarded. You were laughed at behind your back or to your face. I think kids in music school today, I just came back from a couple of days up at the New England Conservatory, up in Boston, and I mean, kids up there. A few days. It happened the week before. I was also gave a talk at the Manhattan School in New York, and kids today, you know, they want to write like Mahler. Teacher says, you know, that's nice. You know? You want to write like, Radiohead. You know, oh, that's nice. You know. You know, you want to write like Steve Reichman? That's nice. You want to write like Stockhausen or Boulez or Milton Babbitt? Oh, that's nice. In other words, we're living in a completely permissive, anything goes aesthetic, where if you were to plump down on something, you'd be labeled some kind of fascist and looked down on. And I'm often, along with others in my generation, been looked at as a liberator. You know, and I often say this to students, I'm not really sure, you know, which one of us got the better deal. You know, what's a better situation? To be up against a stone wall where you either, or you could write like Cage, but it all came out the same. In other words, you can't tap your foot, you can't have steady beat, you can't have anything that's whistleable, melodic. You can't have anything that lets you know what key or what tonal center you're in. And it didn't really much matter if you arrived at that by throwing dice or the I Ching, or whether you had magic squares of numbers the way Boulez did. But if you didn't do that, you were just out of it. Now, that gives you something very... When I went to music school, why did I become a composer? I went to become a composer because I love Bach, because I love Stravinsky, and because I love bebop. Now, none of the above was on the approved list. Oh, well, they were historically there, you know. One wouldn't want to write like that or be influenced by that in any way, shape, or form. So that's the way things were. That's just the way things were.
Yeah, even Copland. Huh?
Exactly. Even, we've talked about Stravinsky, who was, you know, the giant of the age. But in America, the giant, it was, of course, Aaron Copland. And Aaron Copland, again, it people will differ in detail, and Copland did get sick. But before he got sick, he started to write 12-tone music, or again, his version of it, Connotations. And before that, actually, there's a clarinet quartet, a piano quartet. And there's interesting stuff in it, but what's interesting in it is when you can hear Aaron Copland, which is none of the above. And he knew it too, I think. But he didn't want to be, you know, an irrelevance. And I think that's maybe why he kind of stopped writing and became a conductor and a grand old man, a lecturer, and a man on all committees. And because he knew who he was, and he knew people didn't want that. And he'd always been used to being, you know, doing something that was like leading the way, even if it was a return to populism, the way the ballets were. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if Stravinsky and Copland could be stricken down and Benjamin Britten isolated, then, you know, we're talking about some real serious power. So in any event, this now Hall, again, I wasn't, these are kinds of things that Hall and I never discussed, because they weren't really an issue in the early 50s. Or even in 57, or they weren't really an issue to us in what I was doing. It was too early on, and Hall was too wrapped up in the jazz world. I mean, he certainly could see, but that really hadn't hit as hard as it was eventually going to hit.
Now, did Austin know of your interest in jazz, and he knew?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So that's why that.
Yeah, I think he thought Hall was the perfect combination. The jazz musician composer.
Mm-hmm. Now, two people I know, I think, were playing jazz with you, Paul Jeffrey and Rhys Markowitz.
I don't know either one of them.
Those guys were at Cornell.
Paul Jeffrey?
Paul Jeffrey ended up becoming Monk's last saxophonist. And he went to Ithaca College, actually, but he said that he remembers, he's a black guy, played tenor.
Maybe once. Joe Kirtle was a regular tenor player I worked with.
Yeah, Joe Kirtle. The names they mentioned were Buddy Sobel.
Yeah, he became a doctor. I haven't seen him since 1957.
And Phil Arcuri.
That's a name that rings a bell, but I can't say how.
Okay. But anyway, so I guess the point is just that you were coming from a jazz background, and so Hall made some sense.
Yes.
Now, what do you remember about, you mentioned people coming in, who were some of those people, and any particular memories you have of?
Well, I never really spoke with anybody, but I think I remember seeing Mel Waldron either going in or going out. I think I might have seen either Jim Hall or Jim Rennie going in or going out. I might have seen Phil Woods going in or going out. And I remember talking with Hall and going to the Thelonious Monk concerts at Town Hall, of which there were two that I'm aware of. There might have been more. And of Hall explaining to me, you know, how he was working with Monk. He had this old funky Revere tape recorder. I laughed because I had a Wollensack, which was basically the German model for which Revere worked. He had this recorder and this rather funky upright piano, and Monk would come over, apparently, and, you know, just play. And Hall would record it. And then from those recordings, he would, by ear, orchestrate the solos, not the tune necessarily. I mean, he would do the tune too, but I mean, what was interesting is that he would orchestrate the solos. And they became the orchestrations for the big band that Monk played with at Town Hall, and I think never ever toured with, or, you know, I'm not sure. I guess those concerts must have been recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one Town Hall was recorded.
The first one.
Yeah, the first one.
Right.
And you went to that?
Oh yeah.
What do you remember about that?
I liked it a lot. I don't remember much about it, except, you know, that it was a totally. You know, Monk was so, the sound of Monk is so tied up with the sound of the piano that to hear it orchestrated was a real, you know, was a really surprise. And I didn't buy the record, so I guess I wasn't, you know, dying to hear it again and again and again. But I'd be curious to hear again now, you know, how Hall dealt with orchestrating Monk.
One of the miraculous parts of this project is Smith taped many, many hours of those rehearsals. So when Monk came over, there was just
the rehearsals that were held in Hall's Loft for the Town Hall concert, right.
And beginning with just the two of them, Monk and Overton by themselves, and then ending up with the full band in Runcie.
Well, it was just Hall and Monk. What was that? That was Monk playing and Hall recording?
It was both of them playing. Really, you can
four hands on one piano, because I don't think
two pianos.
Oh, he must have rented he must have rented another piano, because he only had one piano regularly.
In the photographs, you can see two pianos.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, maybe there were two pianos there. Yeah, there were two pianos. Yeah.
And yeah, Monk's picking out the music and Hall's writing it down. And there are photographs where you can see Hall standing there with a pad, you know.
Right, taking dictation.
Mm-hmm. But, now I think I read somewhere that you, were you influenced by Monk or an aspect of Four Organs?
Well, there's a chord in Four Organs. There's only one chord in Four Organs. And it's called the dominant 11th chord. It's like the fifth degree is in the bass, and the first degree is on top. So I often refer to it as a chord that's just sort of leaning forward. It's kind of, you know, the bass says, hey, let's go to A, and the soprano is saying, I am A. that chord can be found. A Monk uses, you know, will voice precisely that way, dominant 11th with the tonic degree on top. Debussy does too. Late Debussy, I think it's in the duet or trio that he did near the end. Well, you can hear that chord. I think that Monk definitely, you know, I mean, it wasn't a trademark chord, but it was, it's hard to say. Did I get that chord from Monk? I probably heard it from Monk before I wrote the piece. Did I take it from Monk? No. Could it have been unconscious? Yes. At a certain point, you know, you pour a lot of stuff, you know, you absorb things musically. And unless you're really consciously trying to recreate somebody or, you know, take something from somebody, you know, steal, you know, consciously, which is a perfectly good, healthy thing to do. But if you're not doing that, then, you know, these influences pop up in unforeseen ways. So I simply can't answer your question, but yes, I probably heard it from Monk before I used it. And as I say, I had no intention of doing that and only later reflected on the fact that if you're looking for where else you would find it, you'd probably, the two most obvious suspects would be Monk and late Debussy.
Did Overton talk about Monk at all when you went over to work with him?
No. I mean, you know, I don't, Hall was a very understated man. He was very friendly, and he was very direct, and he didn't pull punches, and he didn't blow his own horn. So if you wanted to find out about what he was doing, you had to ask him. Unless there was something, I suppose, maybe sometime, maybe something minor. I don't remember any, you know, anecdotal thing. That, you know what you're doing reminds me of, none of that. We just, you know, when I was there, it was me and him. And then when I left, it was him and, you know, Al Walden or whoever it was. I mean, see, I don't know what he did with other people because I wasn't there. But, I mean, a man's character is generally fairly consistent. And Hall was the Midwest, as I believe he's from the Midwest, right?
Michigan, the rural Michigan.
Yeah, that's the vibe he gave. And I have a lot of admiration for that kind of character. So sign with me, and I had a very high regard for Hall. Still do. He really was my first teacher. I was really fortunate to have him. He was the right person at the right time with the right message, which is get the basics and keep on working the rest of your life, because you'll never know enough.
Now, what about him as a composer? Do you remember those pieces?
I had a string quartet, right? And a couple of other pieces. I got to be honest and say that, you know, I liked it, what I heard. I probably, there was a series of concerts, the Polakoff concerts up at the Y, given by Max Polakoff, the violinist, which was sort of like the thing in the later 1950s in New York City for new music. And I believe that piece was played up there. But Hall was not exactly one of their featured composers. Hall had a, even then I kind of saw that Hall had kind of a low profile in the composing world. And I, and again, he didn't, you know, I didn't, you know, you don't ask somebody, you know, but well, how do you feel about that? You just, you see what little you can see, and that's that.
Some people have, well, at least one person has said to me that he thinks that Paul was kind of, Hall was a parallel figure to Gunther Schuller, but that his personality was completely different. And
well, that was one thing Hall did talk about. And I mean, just to put it as starkly, I mean, and to be as positive as possible, Hall had it 100% right. Jazz and classical music are two entirely different things. Hall used to talk to me about the fact that we, all of us, then and now, don't have a common practice. And he meant, of course, two things. We don't have the common practice that allowed Bach or Handel to sit down and improvise, or to you know, sit down with somebody else and have a, you know, sort of a competition off a given figured bass that they both would play from, because there was a common practice of how to play a figured bass. And he also meant the common practice of Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Kenny Clarke, and Max Roach, and Dizzy Gillespie, the bebop, you know, that the bebop was a language. And, you know, you could write a lead sheet, which would be the melody and the chords, and people could play it. And they'd play it in different ways, but it was same in a universe of common practice. And what he was saying is that in the world of composition, that's gone. It was gone. It was gone long before we were around. It was gone, you know, when Schoenberg and Stravinsky and other people went in very, very different directions. The 20th century was the end of the period of common practice. Wagner was the beginning of it, but it was really over and done with in the 20th century. And a common practice is not something that you can say, hey, kids, let's start a common practice. It's like saying, hey, kids, let's start a religion. You can do that, but you're being very foolish, and you're being very foolish, because it's not. It is the common practice in music is not something that an individual starts. It's something that an individual inherits from his or her predecessors, and it lives in a culture. It doesn't live in the culture, then doesn't live at all. What an individual does is what an individual does.
And so with the so-called third stream, that was an effort to invent a new common practice.
Yeah, well, I think that's just total. Well, the answer is, where's the masterpiece? After all those years of that kind of thinking, I can't think of a single piece of music that you'd ever want to hear again for 1 minute. I mean, it's just produced absolutely nothing.
But you're saying that Overton never bought into it.
Overton bought out of it. Overton condemned the whole thing. Overton said, this is, you know, foolishness. And went right ahead, you know, working with Thelonious Monk and all these bebop musicians to increase their techniques and to make his contribution that way. And then to write as a composer, which he saw as a separate activity in another world. Now, his jazz may have influenced him. Of course it did. Harmonically, I mean, he was a harmonic composer. And I'm sure that some of the harmonies, you know, overlap, and you could, if you were really analyzing his music, you could point to it. Just the way you could, you know, we were talking about this chord that had become in between me and Thelonious Monk. And the fact that I never could have done what I'd done if I hadn't heard Africa Brass of John Coltrane's and heard John Coltrane play over and over and over again, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 times live, plus his recordings, so many notes on so few harmonies. I mean, some things are in the air. What became later known as, quote, minimalism, was not just coming out of the invention of individuals. Nothing worthwhile ever comes out that way. It comes out of something that's in the air that people who are sensitive to pick up on. It was in the air in an interest in African drumming. It was in the air in interest in Indian music. It was in the air in the interest in Indonesian and particularly Balinese music in my case. It was in the air in Motown and Junior Walker's Shotgun, which is a tune that goes with the bass line, go boom, ba-dee-da-ba-dum. And you're waiting for the, you know, waiting for the B section to release. Well, there is none. It's just A all the way. Well, you know, no one ever heard of that. Well, Junior Walker wasn't thinking about Bali. I mean, or Ravi Shankar. I don't think. You know, it's just it was in the air. You think of Dylan's "I Ain't Gonna Work on Maggie's Farm No More." It's mostly just tonic. So harmonic stasis became the basis of a new style because it was just cropping up. It was time for it to happen. God knows, and God only knows, why somehow that just sort of manifested itself from all kinds of sources, come, you know, outside of Western culture, inside Western culture within the popular field, and inside Western, you know, quote, classical music, as a reaction against the, you know, the incredible lack of the forbidden presence of harmony in music of Boulez and Stockhausen and Barry Yon Cage and so on. But that's what happened. And the third stream thing was just a fantasy. You know, it was an individual concoction whose results were null and void.
Do you think that Overton, if he had these two things, if he had focused on one and done only that, do you think so in other words, was there a tension? Did he feel a tension?
You know, never asked him. He just made it clear that, you know, that they were two separate worlds and that he treated them as separate worlds. And that if you didn't like that, you ought to go find another planet, you know. And I think, you know, what would be really worthwhile now would be to hear a whole lot of Hall's music. I mean, I'd be curious to hear it now, you know, and evaluate it now. So, I mean, if any of what you're doing leads to, you know, a retrospective concert or a series of recordings, that would be, you know, that would be a very worthwhile result of the endeavor that you're find yourself in.
A couple of CDs. I've got. I think I have everything. We found pretty much everything that's been recorded. Okay.
You mean, but it's here and there and everywhere, right?
Well, yeah, but I could put it all on a couple of CDs.
I would appreciate that. Definitely would appreciate that. Okay. If you'd go to that problem, I'd appreciate it.
And then, when you listen to it, if you have any thoughts on who might be the best to perform this or produce a series of concerts of this music. You know, the other idea, which I've mentioned to you, or at least Howard and I thank you for being willing to participate in a concert of Monk of Overton's students or associates as well.
I'd be happy to. I don't know which piece would be most appropriate. I guess it really has to do with, you know, what the performing forces available are. But yes, absolutely, I would be happy to do that.
Well, does anybody come to mind as to who we might approach to produce?
You're talking about a recording?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question because, you see, commercially speaking, I have no idea, you know, probably, you know, producing recordings is like jumping into a swimming pool without any water in it nowadays.
The exhibition of Smith's work is going to open at in February of 2010 at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center. Mm-hmm. And WNYC's radio series will be roughly correspondent to those dates, either shortly before or overlapping. And so we would like to have some concerts during that period while the show is at while the show is up. And you know, Dennis, do you know Dennis Russell Davies?
I know him, but I don't know him very well.
He was another student of
He was a student of Hall's? Because he's not a composer. So what was he? He was just studying harmony and theory with him, something like that.
Yeah. And he's very devoted to him still today.
Well, then there's the conductor. I don't know how much Hall, so my to my knowledge, again, I don't really know, you know, his total output by a long shot. I don't know how much orchestra, does he have much orchestral music?
A little bit. I mean, he has an opera, like
yeah, I think I remember that.
An opera. And then he has a symphony, and he has
right.
a piece called, my favorite piece of his is called Pulsations, which is has drums, and it's maybe 12 pieces, I think. But I'll send you comments.
I appreciate that.
Well,
I appreciate that.
What do you think of it?
Yeah, maybe if I heard it, I'd get some idea. But I mean, it's you know, we're living in a world increasingly of niche markets, and if you do this this exhibition of Smith's, it'll be a traveling. It'll go from the Mamasam.
Yeah. It'll be New York, Chicago, somewhere in California, either LA or San Francisco, Pittsburgh. And then at Duke and at the University of Arizona.
Well, you know, then maybe if you went to can't go to Monk anymore, but the if you could sort of dredge up the Monk Town Hall concert as sort of one of your marquee items. And is Phil Wood still with us?
He is. He's got emphysema, but he's hanging in there.
He might be someone to discuss who amongst the people who study with Hall would want to get together and kind of do something in his memory, that, you know, like a few tunes,
right,
that would make up a CD. And then let's see, what other composers did Druckmann's? No, Druckmann didn't say with Hall.
I think he might have. Yeah.
You might have. I'm trying to think, you know, who studied with Hall as a composer, and I'm coming up short. Who else that you know of?
Well, I know instrumentalists, Joel Krosnick.
Joel Krosnick.
Yeah.
Great player.
But I can't think of any other composers.
When he went into Juilliard, then there were a lot of people who studied with him. But we don't know, you know, that whole period, who his students were at Juilliard must have been, you know, you have to have 3-4 students every semester at least. So maybe you could find out through the school.
Actually, his widow gave me a date book that he had from one of the last years of his life. And even when he was teaching at Juilliard, he kept a very active group of students that were working with him at the law. And his date book is full of like hundreds of names. I mean, it's amazing how hard he worked with his teaching. I mean, he'd have people booked like every hour from 9 a.m. till midnight on a Saturday.
Wow, while he was at Juilliard.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And I don't know if he did it because he needed the money or if he just loved it or some combination.
Is his widow alive?
Yeah.
Well, she'd be the one to answer that question.
Well, their relationship, sort of, they never divorced, but they grew apart.
Well, with a schedule like that, it's not hard to understand. Well, should I ask her to think?
I just had a couple of things I wanted to ask, but I'm afraid we're picking up. Yeah.
Okay, so ask her. Thank
you.
Sarah, you were better.
I just had a couple of things. Going back to what you were talking about, the kind of anything goes aesthetic that we have now with music, and then going back to that period where really my impression is that there, forgetting about the third stream, that there were very few people who were able to even think about being in both camps, in both jazz and classical, the way Overton was. Is that true, or was that also in the air?
I think Hall stood alone in being somebody who was a composer and who was a professional jazz musician and someone who really, you know, had a place within the jazz community. I think he was totally unique. I haven't got a clue to anybody else who, which means it was kind of a, you know, kind of a lonely situation to be in.
whole idea of putting jazz into the concert hall, which, you know, just the idea of those town hall concerts was pretty unusual at the time.
Well, come on now. Benny Goodman played Carnegie Hall back in the 30s. I beg to differ. Uh-huh. No, I think that's fine. And I think you know, I think jazz in concert halls is fine. Why must jazz be relegated to clubs? You know, I think jazz has proved to be and really always was. It was never dance music. You know, rock and roll was a dance music. Jazz was a listening music. And I don't think that the fact that Monk was in Town Hall was, you know, I mean, so Monk was in Town Hall, but, you know, as I say, Benny Goodman had been at Carnegie Hall in the 30s, and that was, you know, whatever, however you want to look at it, Gershwin stuff, you know, was done in concert halls, and then, of course, it was done in Broadway. And,
still, it seems like you could only name, you know, three or four. I mean, there was Jazz at the Philharmonic, I guess, and there was, as you say, there was Gershwin, and there was Benny Goodman, but there wasn't.
Well, it wasn't a common thing. No, it wasn't a common thing the way it's become nowadays, you know, where, because jazz is really, has become marginalized by the ascendancy of rock and roll and all the associated music associated with it. So that it's kind of taken refuge in the concert hall.
What I'm referring to is the kind of atmosphere from that period of the notion of swinging the classics, that there was somehow this, you know, the idea of the classical musician who, you know, took off his white tie and tails and started to swing. The idea
that sounds like Paul Whiteman. I mean, that sounds like something way, that sounds like an idea of the 20s or something. Mm-hmm. I don't get, you mean in terms of, you mean Monk at Town Hall?
No, I mean just generally the atmosphere. I'm looking for some way to describe the relationship at that time between so-called serious music and jazz, so-called classical music and jazz. It was an uneasy relationship. I mean, there was Overton. He was working at Juilliard by day. They weren't interested in jazz at Juilliard.
At that time, right. I think also we're talking about, you know, I mean, now... you know, Princeton's got, you know, Steve Mackey's electric guitar is his primary instrument. You know, Princeton went from Edward Cohn and Milton Babbitt to Mackey and, what's his name, the guy who does the great tape music, Paul Lansky, you know, a sort of homemade tape piece, rock and roll. I mean, you could study rock and roll recording techniques at Princeton. I mean, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable given, you know, recent history, or not so recent history. So there's been a huge change in academic musical training. Something that I personally have, the idea when I got out of school was basically, you know, if I were to give the pieces that I was, the early pieces that I was doing, like piano phase, or violin phase, or later on drumming, you know, to Ensemble X, they would look at me and say, you know, what is this? This is junk, you know, this is foolishness, this is infantile. And so the only way to get people to take me seriously was to play it myself with friends and musicians who I got to know, who were interested in, you know, also in non-Western music, also in jazz, and I mean, there was a turning point starting to happen in the late 60s, early 70s, and that's just gained huge steam. So now I can go to Riga in Latvia or Seoul, South Korea, and find musicians who can play my music and play it well. And I'm just turning up for the just rehearsal. It's in them. It's in their bones. Why? Well, they heard a lot of pop music when they were young. When they were studying their instrument, they heard my music because their teacher played it for them, or they heard a recording of it, or a friend of them was working on it. And so when they got to actually doing it, they looked at me and said, well, you know, what's the problem? Because when you encounter something when you're 16, 17 years old, it's not the same as when it's being composed and everybody in the room is like, you know, 32, 33 years old. So, and that's true throughout music history. You know, I mean, if somebody 1920, I don't know when Bartok wrote the fourth quartet, 1928, around in there, I'm sure a lot of people said, you know, Mr. Bartok, this is incredible. Do you really expect anyone to play this? And now, you can't be a string quartet without playing Bartok. Well, now, how does that, well, you know, they were all stupid, now they're all smart. No, little by little, the techniques that he introduced became introduced to younger and younger musicians, and they saw it and heard it at an earlier stage in your life until it became just, well, you know, so when it has that mean, it just means you snap the string off the fingerboard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So was Hall hip to that before other people were?
I think that Hall wasn't concerned with that at all. And he didn't live, or maybe he was near the end of his life, he was beginning to see that sea change happen, that overlap happen, not in a conscious third stream way, but on a gut level of common practice, of people growing up hearing things, having it affect their playing, because that's the way life is. And I think that that might have been something that, you know, again, when I didn't know him, when I didn't have contact with him, might have been something that made him, you know, sort of scratch his head and think hopefully positive thoughts, because I think certainly he would have recognized that what it is that he rejected was the conscious, you know, changing of hats and saying, you know, now be having a good time, you know.
I have one question about in your book of writings published by Oxford University Press.
Yeah.
There's a paragraph where you describe Eugene Smith.
What did I say?
just the insanity of his space.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, well, Eugene Smith did not come across as your normal human being in my one meeting with him. I just remember, you know, there's one overpowering image, which is I walked into this room, and this room was wall to wall. You know, it was four walls of photographs, or, you know, every available. Obviously, there was a door. But outside of that, you know, it just seemed to be all photographs. But it wasn't just that. You know, every photo, there was like all these photographs that were attached to the wall. And then into those photographs were stuck other photographs, which were kind of like leaning, you know, because they weren't really like carefully, you know. And then behind them were other sort of stuff. So the whole room was kind of like, you know, this leaning series of photographs about to fall and engulf you. And then he just seemed, you know, he was a very intense vibe. And I enjoyed it immensely. I mean, I knew of him because of Life magazine. I mean, I knew he was the famous photographer who had done Spanish Civil War. That's how I, you know, that was my image of Eugene Smith before I met him. And I knew that he lived downstairs from Hall. And I don't know how it was that maybe Hall set up and said, "Hey, Gene, take a listen to this kid's thing," or something. And he was... and. Busy as Smith must have been, he seemed like he always had time. You get the impression that he was just, you know, interested. And he was obviously interested in what was going on up in Hall's world. So that was my one and only meeting with him. And then, you know, we played this piece, which I don't want you to play because it's not a very, very good piece. But he certainly was a sympathetic. I felt great playing it for him. You know, like, wow, you know, a real artist, you know, hearing my music. Isn't that wonderful? But, you know, that was it. I never saw him again. And I didn't know what his relationship was, you know, to the world upstairs, so to speak.
Do you remember the law physically? Do you remember the creaky stairway? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. It was a mess.
What was it like?
Oh, it's like a lot of law buildings. I mean, it was, you know, I don't know, 5-6 feet wide, plain unpainted wood steps, probably a little cockeyed, you know, and unpainted or nondescript walls that I can't even remember. And no, I mean, it was before the era of spanking white walls. My generation brought that in. I don't know how many lofts that I had. I don't know that I, you know, rollered white, but I'm never going to do that again. But this was before that, and this was sort of like, you know, faded yellow. It was just really funky old buildings above what was then the Flower Market, which was then a really, you know, a neighborhood, a known neighborhood. It also had, I think, a lot of stores that sold buttons and threads. I know Beryl had an aunt who used to go down there to get stuff for her embroidery. I mean, things that are just not part of our lives anymore. It really represents a, as did the original Tribeca when I moved down there before the World Trade Center was even built. I saw it being built. So it was a real, you know, it wasn't the place that said center of the arts. I mean, you just had to know that there was this building and that there were these people there. Otherwise, it was just, you know, buttons and bows and flowers.
This is the last thing for me. Do you remember if Overton had a relationship with Henry Cowell or Morton Feldman?
Gosh, I don't know. Cowell? Howell? When did Cowell pass away?
I'm not sure.
Me neither. He was at the New School. Kate studied with him. I never got the vibe that Hall was in the, you know, avant-garde. That wasn't part of his vibe. He was aware of most everything. You know, I'm certainly probably knew several of Cowell's pieces. I'm sure he knew the Banshee. Probably knew some. Hall was a very well-informed musician. Feldman. Someone that I knew, someone I had very, very high regard for and have a higher regard for now that he's gone than I even did when he was around. I can't imagine the two of them. I don't know that. I'm sure Hall was, and everyone was aware of Morty. I mean, he certainly was aware. At that point, he probably wouldn't have been too impressed with the graph stuff. I think Hall would have been more impressed with what Morty did later on. And I don't know if Hall died in the 70s, Morty was still in the graph stuff then. I don't know if he would have taken that too seriously. But again, you know, I'm on real shaky territory. He never, you know, those names did not, okay, you know, did not emerge in our conversations.
The only thing I have has nothing to do with the jazz lift. I just wanted to hear you say a few words about Darius Milhaud, if you had much contact with him at Mills, but it's not related to this.
Well, now, what is this for? You're doing a program on older composers who are freshly dead?
Overton was a student.
Oh, right. Well, Milhaud must have taught, you know, talk about numbers of students. He must have had more than, he must have the grand prize. By the time I got to stay with Mio, it was 1962, I would guess. And he was old and sick. And I got the overall impression that really he would have been lonely if he didn't have students around him. And that was the real, you know, impetus behind it. We were supposedly studying Boris Godunov and how Ravel had ruined it with his fancy orchestration. And taking the rough power away from it. And I remember that Milhaud talked enormously about Satie. An enormous, a great deal about Musique de Meblement. As a matter of fact, talked about it so much that you almost got the impression that he wished he was Satie, that he had this enormous regard for Satie and for what Satie had done, and for the, you know, the more far out things that Satie had done. But in terms of, you know, of studying with somebody, it was Berio was really where the person I was learning, you know, from, in a totally different way than Hall. I mean, you know, Berio was the kind of teacher from whom you, in a sense, looked over his shoulder and saw what he was interested in. And at that sense, at that point, that was really what was happening, you know, like it or not. And also Berio being Italian, being who he was, you know, it was just a whole lot looser and a whole lot more flexible than other people in that neck of the woods. And so he was open to jazz, and well, you probably maybe have heard this, but I mean, when the way I had to deal with 12-tone music too. So how did I deal with it? Well, the way I dealt with it is you never transpose the row, never invert the row, never retrograde the row, just repeat the row over and over again. And Berio saw this and said, you know, if you want to write tonal music, why don't you write tonal music? And I said, that's what I'm trying to do. But I mean, he had no malice against it. So he was just, you know, looking it over and saying, oh, this is what you're doing. Why don't you do that? And he was curious about jazz. He wanted to hear, you know, he was open to American jazz. And but Mio, as I say, was you know, near the end of his life. And really not the teacher that he might have been 10 years earlier that I just didn't experience.
I guess one reason I thought of him was to talk about people who were influenced by jazz and who...
Yes, at a much earlier stage, yeah. At a much earlier stage. Le Bouffe sur la Toile, I mean, that's 20s jazz. Yeah. I mean, people influenced by jazz is almost everybody in the 20th century. I mean, maybe not Stockhausen, but everybody else.
What's your address? It's 114...
Horseshoe Hill Road.
Tone?
Sure. Horseshoe Hill Road, Pound Ridge, and
10576.
Okay, I'm gonna send you some of the Overton recordings.
That's great, good.
And I really appreciate you listening to them and let me know what you think.
Well, send me your email address when you send the CDs.
Do you want any more information about the project? I mean, I have a couple of articles that about what we're up to. If you're interested.
Sure. I mean, that's.
Okay, we just need 5 seconds of silence so we can take room tone.